Okay, this is supposed to be number two on The Chosen People. I tried to record number one yesterday on this recorder, but it ran out of battery. Somebody else recorded most of it and sent it to me in an email, so I'll make that available to you, David. And I hope you can splice them together. If not, we'll have to make do with whatever's left on his recording of the first shir. Okay, let's summarize what we got up to yesterday, and then we'll push on. We were talking about equality, and I said there are two concepts of equality, descriptive and normative. Descriptive means people in fact are equal. Normative means people should be treated equally. And I said, with respect to both of them, there are sometimes where it's right and sometimes where it's wrong. A blanket principle across the board that people are equal or should be treated equal is incorrect. Both of those will have certain exceptions. And therefore, if someone wants to oppose chosenness on the grounds that chosenness violates equality, and the critic will say that we have a general principle of equality and admits no exceptions, it's got to be maintained across the board, no one is going to mount that kind of criticism because no one believes in a principle of equality that works across the board. Now, I did rethink one thing I said yesterday, and maybe the way I said it was either wrong or misleading. And then I said it a second way, which was probably better. We're talking about normative equality. Obviously, people aren't treated the same. Usually, they aren't treated the same because factually they aren't the same. Their factual differences mean they have to be treated differently. What about equality as a kind of default position? Treat everyone equally unless you have a reason to treat them different. Which means we recognize you could override equality if there were good reason to do so, but you need a reason to do so. And if you have no reason, one way or the other, then you treat everybody equally. Now, I think that's a mistake. I think that any way you treat people needs to be justified. Whatever way you treat people, you can be asked, why do you treat them that way? And if you treat people equally, the reason has to be, well, in the relevant respects, those characteristics that are relevant to this kind of treatment, the people are in fact equal. And that's a positive judgment. If you treat them differently, and you're asked, why do you treat them differently? Then the answer has to be because in the relevant respects that are relevant to this treatment, they're unequal. Treating them equally and treating them unequally have the same requirement for a reason, for a justification, for an explanation. Why did you treat them that way? And in both cases, the reason, the explanation, has the same form. I treated them in this way because if you look at them, you'll see their circumstances require them to be treated in this way. That's just as correct a requirement for treating them equally as it is for unequally. We don't say, well, if you treat them equally, there's no question, there's no answer, there's no reason, there's no justification, everything's fine. We give you credit for having done the right thing without any investigation at all. Only if you treat them unequally, then we're going to pin you down. Then we're going to make you give us a reason why for what you did. The same, exactly the same for equal treatment. To say that equality is a default position means there are times when, if the treatment is equal, you get away with it with no other reason, Whereas in the same circumstances, the treatment's unequal, then you have to have a reason. Then you have to give me some explanation as to why you did what you did. And what I'm saying is that we're never in that condition. It's just that when people are treated equally, we may just assume that, of course, they were treated equally because the conditions were, in fact, identical for all of them. But the minute that assumption becomes problematic, then we are certainly going to ask for a justification. If you'll test for driving a car, and you say only literate people can drive cars, so you're not treating people equally, then you'll be asked, why are you treating them unequally? If you made a law which said every 18-year-old is entitled to drive a car, I think people would be definitely up in arms. Every 18-year-old? You mean without literacy as a requirement? Without passing a driver's test as a requirement? Every 18-year-old can drive a car? You're treating them as if they're equal, and they aren't equal. So our surprise as to why you treated them that way will be determined by whether the conditions behind the treatment justify the treatment. And there'll be no preference for treating them equally as against treating them unequally. Yeah.
So what you're saying is that by treating people blindly equally, that you're actually treating them like in an unequal way opposed to their merit or their condition?
Okay, if you put it that way, it's going to sound paradoxical. What I would say is if you treat people blindly equally, then you're treating them unfairly. Imagine that you draft people to the army and you choose people for the infantry by lot. Everybody has an equal chance to go into the infantry. Other people will say, that's insane. The fat ones, the skinny ones, the strong ones, the thin ones, the agile ones, the clumsy ones, treating them all the same with respect to going to the infantry, that's dumb. You don't do that. You do an assessment of their talents, their strengths, their weaknesses, and you put them in the place where their service will be best. You don't treat everyone equally. It's just a stupid thing to do.
So then, like, equal treatment is actually doing a disservice.
That's right. Equal treatment will be doing a disservice, and it'll be unfair. I would say it's generally unfair to a person to put him in a position where he can't maximize his talents and his usefulness unless there's some other reason why he shouldn't do that.
Now, what about, like inalienable human rights and treating people equally that way, giving everyone an equal platform to stand on?
Good. So I said yesterday there might be rights where the appropriate target group is the entire population. There might be rights like that. Not all rights are like that. Right to vote isn't like that. But there might be rights like that. Okay. But then it's not that I have a principle of equality. It's that in this particular case, I make the moral judgment that everybody should have the right. That's not because of equality. That's because of the kind of right that it is, like the right to free speech or freedom of motion or freedom of worship or whatever it is. Right? And the proof of it is that there are times when people want to deny that, right? Like Satan worship, where you have states that prohibit Satan worship, and they don't say they have the right to freedom of worship. Well, I know it's an amendment to the Constitution, but there are other factors that override that. Okay? Then we briefly mentioned at the end the idea of a principle of making people equal. And that's, I think, a large part of our welfare concerns. To make up inequalities between people. I made two remarks about that. Number one, notice that that assumes people are factually unequal and assumes that it's right to treat people unequally. So if you are committed to trying to lessen the differences between people, you are admitting that the principles of descriptive and normative equality have exceptions. And secondly, in terms of the Jewish position, that's perfectly reasonable. As I pointed out, historically, God made an attempt to reach all mankind on a number of occasions. And even now, the door is open, and it is preferable, valuable, laudable. Any Jew, non-Jew who wants to become a Jew is certainly a great thing to do. So we're not committed to a privileged position, to a two-tiered system. The contrary, we'd be very happy if there weren't a two-tiered system. Okay, that was by way of clearing the decks. Now let's talk about what chosenness means. Let's try to do a positive analysis of the concept and see what its implications are. In certain quarters, you'll be told that chosenness is a matter of role, challenge, job, contribution. There are certain things that need to be provided to the world, and as in smaller groups, division of labor is very efficient. God established different nations with different contributions to make for the world at large. Now, that way of putting it has a kind of unspoken implication. The reason it sounds so congenial to a modern liberal point of view is because the unspoken implication is I'm only talking about your job. I'm not talking about what you are. I'm not saying that you're inherently different from other people. I'm just saying that this is what you're doing, what you're contributing. But as an explanation, the Jewish concept, it won't wash for two reasons. First of all, the classical sources are all against it. Classical sources talk about inherent difference between the Jewish people and others. And second of all, if you're talking about God assigning these different roles to different nations, then it's absurd to think that God assigned a role to a nation without taking into account its particular strengths and weaknesses, talents and disabilities, and its particular national character. Now let me expand on this a little bit. What should we think about stereotypes? Stereotypes have a terribly bad name. But the truth is that stereotypes typically are very useful. And they are based on, usually on a reality. Groups attract stereotypes, usually, there are exceptions, but usually because there's a certain consistency in the behavior of the people of that group. Okay, is it 100% consistent? No. But if it's 96% consistent, then you are well informed when you use the stereotype in your interactions with those people. Of course, you should keep your eyes open. Maybe this is an exception. But on the other hand, you should be well aware that chances are it isn't an exception and pattern your behavior correctly. Every good travel book will tell you that people in this country have these customs, these priorities, these preferences, these sensitivities, and you should be careful not to step on their toes. My wife once spent some hours in Paris in between flights. She had studied French in college. And she, this was after high school, she's very good at languages. Anyway, she tried out French on one of the native speakers. It was a terrible mistake. The French are very sensitive about their language. And if you don't pronounce it like a native, they think you're murdering the language and they have nothing but contempt for you and they show irritation. No American does that. Somebody immigrates to America from Poland and mispronounces the language. People are quite kind, and they'll answer him as best they can, and you know, maybe help correct his pronunciation if he needs it. But the French have very strong feelings about their language. Do you know that there is an agency of the French government whose job it is to legislate the language, to determine what is correct French and what is incorrect French? That would be unthinkable in the United States. It just would be a non idea. But they have different feelings about their language. In China, if you're visiting someone and they offer you a second cup of tea, that is an invitation to leave. They don't want you anymore. If you don't know that, you're going to have very strained social relations. So we'd like a second cup of tea? Sure, terrific. I got another 3/4 of an hour. Yeah, let's converse. They don't want you. They want you to leave. In some cultures, when you finish a meal that your hostess provided, it is the minimal of good taste to burp. If you don't burp, then you didn't appreciate the food, and they take it as an insult. I was in England and I was listening to BBC, which is, of course, almost always a mistake. And they were interviewing some Chinese immigrants to Britain, and they said, when you meet someone you haven't seen for a long time, two Chinese people, it is a great compliment of one to say to the other, my, but you're looking fat. Why is that a compliment? Because it means you have enough money to buy food. Otherwise, people are thin because they're starving. Right? Try that with your American friends. Right? So what you have here is a difference in cultural forms, cultural norms, cultural preferences, cultural expression. Now, could you find exceptions? Yes, but you better not bank on that. I was once in another country, and I, as I realize now, faultlessly used a gesture that we use innocently, and I was almost murdered for it. Because in that country, that gesture is a gross insult. And here, it's, you know, just communication. It didn't occur to me that the gesture could, you know, get you into trouble. And someone came over, but then he realized that I wasn't a native, and he explained to me, don't do that here. People will not appreciate it. So stereotypes are, in fact, very useful, and they are generally correct. There is such a thing as national character. National character. Now, let's imagine God deciding to whom he's going to assign the project of living according to the Torah. The Torah has rules for every aspect of life. Civil law, criminal law, prayer, charity, clothing, speech, thought, emotions, every aspect of life. Shall we imagine God making this assignment blind? Wouldn't that be self-defeating? Shouldn't the fact that God took this challenge and assigned it to a certain group of people mean that this group of people is the best suited by its inherent characteristics to succeed at this challenge?
You make it sound like slavery taught us to obey.
Well, that's not a bad observation, actually, that slavery taught us to obey. There are sources that talk about that. But how did you get to that from what I said? I don't see any connection.
Well, I mean, when he chose us to receive it,
oh, okay.
We were slaves, you know, constantly obeying.
Okay. So the truth is, you made a nice jump. I don't usually get to that till three steps down the line. So you're saying Jewish national character is dependent in part on Jewish national experience, which is quite correct, and he gave it to a group of slaves. Should we read some appropriateness of our having been slaves into choosing us? Now, I think your observation is 100% correct. We definitely should. Indeed, the Torah says it over and over again. In more than a dozen places, the Torah says, I'm commanding you this, remember you were slaves in Egypt. So the Torah itself is saying, this is an expression of your national consciousness. Now, I don't know if... One thing at a time. I don't know if the particular connection you're describing, that being slaves taught us to obey, is the connection that the Torah is envisioning. There are mitzvos which require us to have sympathy for people who are disadvantaged. And there the Torah says, remember, you were strangers in Egypt. You lived in a disadvantaged condition. You should apply your experience to them. That's a connection, but it's not the connection of learning to obey. And indeed, some sources indicate that if you spent a period of time as slaves and you finally get your freedom, maybe that will be the worst condition in which to ask for more slavery. When you finally get your freedom, you're in no condition to say, I'm prepared to just give it up. And therefore, accepting the Torah, where we're willing to pledge allegiance to God, is overcoming a resistance of freed slaves, not continuing the condition of slaves. I think psychologically, you could read it either way. I think your general observation is correct. Yes, if God chose us because we have the national character we have, and if, as you assumed correctly, national character is molded by your historical experience, then one should read through the experiences to a connection why God gave the Torah that challenge to a group that's gone through these experiences. I think the logic of your remark is 100% correct. Yeah.
We were considered chosen before we were considered slaves.
That's a very difficult thing to sort out. Really, Today, when we talk of ourselves as chosen, what we mean is that we alone possess the Torah and are obligated by it. If we mean that, it didn't apply to the Jews before Sinai because they didn't possess the Torah and they were not obligated by it. True, we have sources which talk about choosing us prior to the mitzvos, in the Kiddush for Yom Tov, which we're going to say in 2 weeks, Mitzvah Hashem, it does have that order. But there, I think the meaning is it's a potential choice, or it's a choice for the sake of the future. You know what it's a little bit like? It's a little bit like the debate about abortion, where you consider the fetus at a stage before it's human. Even at a stage before it's human, many people do not regard the human fetus as equivalent to a mouse. Because it's the kind of thing which, if left to its own devices, will become human. Whereas the mouse will never become human. It's a potential human. The fact that it's a potential human gives it a status even before it's human. And I think that's what we're talking about here. The choice of the Jewish people before they're giving the Torah is a choice for the sake of the Torah that they're going to receive. It's a choice in the light of the fact that they're going to receive the Torah later. But in terms of, and there's a special relationship with God, I don't think the Torah ever uses that term before the revelation at Sinai. The text of the Torah itself never uses that term before the text is.
He promises Abraham, he promises all of them that your kid, that you know you're going to be the chosen.
I don't think you have that. I'm segula, and that's those terms come later. So that to my mind, that would mean that the relationship that he had with them was in the light of the future. For example, when Moses says to God, why are you taking them out of Egypt? They don't deserve it. What does God say? When they go out, they'll serve me on this mountain, meaning they'll receive the Torah on this mountain. So he asks, why are you taking them out? Not because of what they have in the past. I'm taking them out as an investment in their future that they'll receive the Torah. That's what makes them special now. What makes them special now is they're going to develop into that future. That's what I'm talking about.
So can you say that God sent them to be slaves in order that they should be able to receive the Torah?
Absolutely. So absolutely.
You could have sent any other nation to be slaves.
That doesn't follow. That doesn't follow. If I train an athlete to compete in the Olympics, it doesn't follow that anyone else who was trained could compete in the Olympics. Right? You're confusing a necessary sufficient condition with a sufficient condition.
Well, you're saying the reason why they're able to receive the Torah was a big reason was because they were slaves.
No, you started off the reason, and then you shifted to big reason because you know it's not the only reason, and that's the key. The key is it is part of the process that developed. His remark was accurate. Since this is part of the process, so the choice of giving us the Torah has to reflect that also, but not only that.
So in other words, he realized beforehand that they should be there, that they're the right people, and therefore he wanted to, tone them up for the situation.
Not bad. He realized before that they're the people who should do it, and therefore he put them through this process, which is a necessary condition for anyone who would do it, but they're the right people to do it. Correct.
But, like, at some point, they also accepted to be chosen, which is one of the requirements of chosen, is to accept the choosing, correct?
That's true for Abraham. I think
well, I mean, according to Ramchal, Sinai, the Jewish people would be like, no, forget it, we wouldn't be chosen right now.
No, that's not correct. That's not correct. We'll talk about that in the night of Shavuos. God's holding the mountain over their heads after they said we accept it,
yeah,
is designed to teach, says the Maharal, that even if they had said no, they wouldn't have had any option to avoid it. Even if they had said no, they wouldn't have had any option. It's an objective necessity that the world needs this. And just to give you a tiny bit of background, but I don't want to do that whole shiur now. When God commanded Adam, and through Adam, all of his descendants, God didn't say to Adam, would you voluntarily accept a restriction against murder? Are you willing to accept that or not? He simply said, thou shalt not murder, period. And when he commanded Noah and his descendants not to eat the flesh of living animals, and then asked them if they would like to be restricted in that way, he simply commanded them. And when he commanded Abraham to circumcise himself and all of his descendants except for Ishmael and Esav, so he didn't ask him if you want to be circumcised, he simply commanded it. The creator of the universe doesn't need our free agreement. The real situation is the opposite. When he asked us before he gave us the Torah at Sinai, that needs explanation. Why did he bother? Seeing as how he didn't really need it. Okay, so that, we'll talk about that in another
so there has to be something in our decision that creates the situation that we come to.
Well, not necessarily. It could have a different purpose. We'll talk about this in another issue. Anyway, so saying that chosenness is merely a matter of one's contribution, one's challenge, is not correct. It has to reflect the inherent difference between the groups. Now, at this point, the right thing to do would be to say what the difference is. And the really accurate way to do it would be this. Go through the entirety of the Torah and then match it up and say, okay, since this is the whole of the challenge, this group is best to address that challenge and read off the sum total of the challenge, the important characteristics of the group. It's the right way to do it. It would only take 3 or 4 lifetimes, and therefore I'm not going to even attempt it. What I'm going to do is give you one way of describing the difference between the Jewish people and other peoples. It's not the only way. I'm doing it this way because I was trained in philosophy, and that's most natural for me, but there could be other ways to do it. It would be just as accurate and as insightful. But I'll do it my way, and then I will explain to you what the consequences are. If I finish just describing the idea today, I'll be happy, and then we'll finish up the entire discussion on Sunday, B'ezras Hashem. I want to talk to you about value. Different types of value. You're all familiar with the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic value. I mentioned that only to put it aside. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something quite different, which I don't think is discussed anymore in philosophy. I think I once saw it in Sidgwick's Methods of Ethics, which goes back more than 100 years. It's a forgotten distinction, but I want it. It's good. It's important for my purposes. And what I'm telling you now is really an insight that I got from Rabbi Nochum Lansky of Nei Yisrael Yeshiva in Baltimore many, many years ago. We used to learn together. This and the application, it's all his Torah. The difference is between what I would call comparative value on the one hand and non-comparative value on the other hand. Sometimes when you say X is good, what you mean is X is better than its alternative, than its contrast. Those aren't the same. Let's say contrast. When you say X is good, all you mean to be doing is making a comparative judgment between X and its contrast. If you say that health is good, what you probably mean is that it's better to be healthy than it is to be ill. If you say wealth is good, if someone would say that, what he probably means is it's better to be wealthy than to be poor or middle class. If someone says education is good, what he probably means is that it's better to be educated than to be ignorant. It's really an inherently comparative judgment. That's one type of value. One could conceive of another type, where when I say X is good, I don't mean to be comparing X with its contrast. I mean to be describing X without consideration of its contrast. Now you may say, I don't see how that's possible. If you're talking about X, of course, if you have X, you don't have its contrast. Its contrast contradicts it. So how can you imagine or think of X and evaluate it, think of what its value is, and somehow just block out of your mind the fact that when you have X, you don't have its contrast, and automatically you're talking about a comparative judgment. How could you achieve that state of mind? Here's what Rabbi Lansky said. Imagine that God is contemplating whether or not to create the universe. He's thinking about it. And he asks you for your opinion. Don't ask me how you got there. And you say, God, I'm in favor. Says, God, I'm in favor. Why are you in favor? Because if you create the universe, there'll be X. And X is very valuable. X makes it worth it. Now, said Rabbi Lansky, consider what you're doing. At present, you have neither X nor its alternative. If you recommend that God create the universe in order to bring X into existence, you're not saying merely that X is better than its alternative. With the judgment that X is better than its alternative, you can't justify a judgment of creating X out of nothing. Here you have to be saying that X's value transcends its merely being better than its alternative. That's what Rabbi Lansky said. When he said that, I was reminded of another way to put the point from the other end. I grew up at a time when World War III and the annihilation of the world was around the corner. We were trained to hide in the schools, in the halls of our schools, with our crash position to protect your neck from broken vertebrae and all that kind of stuff. When you heard a boom from a construction site, you thought it was a Russian H-bomb landing on your city, and you thought the world was over. You know, we grew up with that. There was a famous book which was made into a movie called On the Beach, which portrayed the end of the world. Of course, a little grandiose, it means no more human beings. Cockroaches will do fine. Radiation doesn't bother them. But that's what it was. Now, of course, it made a big impact on people. People thought about it, were shaken by it. End of the world, end of all of mankind. What a tragedy. What an enormous, gigantic tragedy. There were a few partially insane philosophers who asked, why would it be a tragedy? What exactly is the tragedy in the end of the human race? Now, the answer has to be something like this. Well, if the human race ends, then you're going to lose X. And losing X will be a gigantic loss. Usually, the X that you will lose with the end of the human race will be accompanied by its contrast. You lose X and its contrast. Also, you'll lose both of them. Whether it's technology or wealth or health or insight or, you know, psychology or philosophy, you know, whatever it is, if you think of the contrast, the end of the human race means you're going to lose both of them. So when you say, my God, the end of all human beings is a terrible tragedy because we're going to lose X, it can't be you're just saying X is better than its alternative, because you're going to lose them both. You have to be saying something more. You have to be saying that X has a certain value which goes beyond merely being better than its alternative.
Value, like, at the beginning and at the end, but is there any way to have this type of value somewhere in the middle?
No. I understand me. I didn't say that the value was at the beginning, at the end. I said, if you made such a statement,
yes,
then you're giving X that kind of value.
Okay, but
wait a second, so that means that when it exists, it has that value, whether you're at the beginning, the middle, or the end. When I say to God, create the universe, because when you do so, X will come into existence. So later, when after he creates that, the X is there, it has that kind of value. It's not that it has the value only when I'm talking to God. I'm saying that you should create the universe because if you do, there will be X, and X has that kind of value. It means it will have it when it's there, not just while I'm talking to you. While I'm talking to you, there isn't any X. I'm talking about what it will be when it gets there. Now, this at least abstractly could be a consistent idea. Notice the difference between them in terms of how you'll use these values. If I ask, should I invest in someone's health? Should I invest in his education? Should I invest in his means of living? In all cases, the answer can be a comparative judgment. Sure, he's ill. He'll be better off if he's healthy. Sure, he's ignorant. He'll be better off if he has information. Sure, he's starving. He'll be better off if he has more money. If I ask what I should do for an already existing person, comparative values are enough to give me guidance as to what I should do. They won't help if you are considering whether or not the human being should exist altogether. Suppose a person is contemplating having children. And he says, listen, I'm just trying to decide whether I should have a child or not. As of now, he doesn't exist. I'm contemplating bringing him into existence. And I say, well, you know, I can ensure that he'll be healthy. Maybe so, but that's no reason to have a child. Health is something to invest in an already existing person. Maybe if he'll be irredeemably ill, that's a reason not to have a child. But because then you can't do for him what you need to do for him. But the fact that he'll be healthy isn't a reason to have a child. He'll be educated. So there'll be another protoplasmic information storage device. So what? Information is useful for people who already exist. But to have a child because he'll store information in his cranium is not a reason. The difference between comparative values on the one hand and non-comparative values on the other hand is this. Non-comparative values justify the very existence of the world, the human race. Whereas comparative values only justify or criticize the particular condition that an already existing person or group or the human race as a whole happens to be in. So we can understand, abstractly at least, the difference between comparative and non-comparative value. At least I hope so. Now, we can state in the glorious abstract one way of putting what makes the Jewish people different from other nations, and that is that we have a greater capacity to realize, create, express non-comparative value than others. We have a greater capacity to realize, to express, to create non-comparative value than others. And this, in abstract terms, is what the Torah challenges us to do. If you understand the Torah correctly, you can see that the Torah is addressed at realizing non-comparative value. Now, I haven't said anything about what the non-comparative values are. That's the next step. But before we get there, you have a question before we get there? Is that, okay. Good. Our minds are flowing down the same path. You know. So, the crucial question now is, what are non-comparative values? Now, I have to tell you, you ask what are values, all you have to go on here is intuitions. All of ethics is just an organization of intuitions. There's no external stance from which you can use leverage to enforce one position or another in ethics. At least no one's found one to date that people agree on.
I mean, you can't use the external force of God's giving as a reason to give?
Well, okay. Let me just rest with the position that I'm taking. I'm just apologizing for the kind of argument I'm going to give you. I'm really just going to appeal to your intuitions, how you feel about these things, how you would describe your own valuing of these things. Let's use Rabbi Lansky's analogy. Imagine advising God on creating the universe. I say, yeah, God, create the universe. You know why? Because when you do, there'll be rich people in it. That's a good reason for creating it. It sounds very silly. You know, that sounds foolish. That's once people are there, maybe there being rich people is useful. But if there are no people, to create people because some of them will be rich sounds frivolous. Create the universe because if you do, there'll be LA fitness clubs. Right? There'll be superb heart lung capacity. Right? You know. Sure, they're great. They're great for people who already exist. But to create the universe for the sake of LA fitness clubs? And I'm speaking as a person who works out regularly, so I have nothing against fitness. I'm all in favor. But that's not a reason to create the universe. You know, if, imagine doing it my way, mourning the passing of the universe. I mean, mourning the passing of mankind. What a tragedy. No more mankind, no more LA fitness clubs. And that's not a reason to mourn the passing of mankind. Or no more Fortune 500 companies. Or no more, you know, richest man in the, no more people as rich as Bill Gates. I mean, Bill Gates is a nice guy, but the riches don't have to be there. So it's, I think most of the things that we value, if we analyze our own feelings about them, our own attitudes about them, we'll find that those values are really comparative values. What is it that has non-comparative value? So, Rabbi Lansky said, there is a certain quality of moral, spiritual excellence. And if I were asked to advise God about the creation, I would say to him, yes. Create the universe because of that quality. If you create the universe, now it's a double thing. There will be people whose lives express that quality. And there'll be moments in everybody's life that express that quality. And it is the life moments, life hours, life years of that quality which justifies the existence of the universe. Now, let me remind you of the words that I said. I said a certain moral spiritual excellence. The word certain is not a throwaway. I endeavor that none of my words should be throwaways. But it's not a throwaway. The words moral and spiritual mean different things in different cultures. They apply to different things in different cultures. Maybe that's a better way of saying it. And therefore, by saying certain, I don't mean everything everyone will call moral and spiritual. I mean a particular moral spiritual excellence which the Jewish tradition describes. Now, this quality is a quality of living. It's not easy to communicate the quality of living. The best way to appreciate it would be to associate with people who have it. Short of that, one should read biographies of people whose lives possessed it and expressed it. I will tell you anecdotes about such people to try to get the idea across. But it's when you observe people living in this way and performing actions of a certain kind, when you are struck by, yes, that's what a human being is meant to be. That's what a human being is at his finest. That's what a human being is when he's, you know, superb. It's that moral spiritual excellence that is of non-comparative value. And it's that which the Jewish people possesses the capacity to develop more so than other people's, and it's that which the Torah addresses us to develop. You have a question?
That is the reason for the creation of the world?
Yes. The reason for the creation of the world is to express that moral spiritual excellence. Yeah.
So, I mean, I was understanding for, I wasn't sure between two. Number one, we say in the world,
okay.
Number two is also, I think we say, the Hashem didn't create the world, like, I don't know if the right words are, I don't know, and it's Mesiv Shkenase. I think it's Mesiv Shkenase. So what I'm saying is, you're going to say because a person is going to be doing something that has a non-comparative value, he's going to be doing something that has some kind of moral excellence, that's a reason alone, because someone's going to actually do a good deed, someone's going to go and give charity. That's a reason to go create the world, that God can go and see someone give charity?
I mean, the way I understand it is that, like, God, in order to show his own, you know, goodness, created something with the capacity to create goodness itself.
What does he need that for?
What does he need? It's not that he needs it, but it is good and giving.
But this is all old stuff, and it's stuff that's really... It's a spin-off. But maybe in the words that I spoke, there's an ambiguity that I didn't realize, and I should make it clear. It didn't occur to me. Rabbi Lansky's example may create a false impression. If I want to give you reasons to do something, I have to know what your principles are. I have to know what your priorities are. I have to know what your values are. It won't do for me to say to you, here's a reason for you to do it, because I value it. What's that got to do with you? That's a natural observation, I think. I don't think Rabbi Lansky's example is taking that into account. If God's considering creating the universe, and I'm giving him my judgment on the matter. If he's asking me, then he's asked me to look at it. Well, that's not necessarily true. But I took Rabbi Lansky's example, his example as a device for distinguishing two ways of looking at value. That's why my example of doing it at the end of history, when the end of mankind, is equivalent. And there I'm not talking to anybody. I'm expressing my valuing. The point of his remark is that there are two ways for me to value something. I can value it comparatively by saying I take it that it's better than its contrast, or I can value it non-comparatively by according it value without just comparing it with its contrast. The idea of seriously giving reasons to God to do what he's doing is not part of the point here. It was just an illustration for bringing out how you value it, two different ways to value. And if that's a trip up, then just cancel it and do it my way. Why would you mourn the passing of mankind? If you would say the passing of mankind is a tragedy because X disappears, then you're giving X non-comparative value. It has nothing to do with advising God what to do. That's not where the point of our discussion lies.
And it can't be because of the Torah?
Well,
the Torah maybe is that moral excellence.
In other words, I'm trying to analyze what that quality is, right? Well, I'm trying to get to a description of what it means to be chosen. The way we got there was, if we're given this challenge, we must be best suited to succeed at that challenge. What is it about us that makes us best suited? I'm trying to give a description of that. That's why I created or copied from Sidgwick this category. Now, when we talk about moral spiritual excellence, I'll tell you the anecdotes next time, but the idea here is an identification with God and with the other that transcends the normal limitations of ego to the point where, as a first thought, one thinks one's willing to sacrifice oneself. But more deeply, one sees that the barrier between self and the other, whether the other is another human being or the other is God, that barrier is a false barrier. Moral spiritual excellence is appreciating the ultimate integration of everything, rather than viewing everything as disconnected, individualistic entities, but rather to appreciate the integration of everything. One thinks here of a famous remark by Aristotle that man is by his very nature social. Modern thinking doesn't accept that point of view. I think they're missing a lot. Man is by his very nature social. Man's identity is carved out largely as a role that he plays vis-a-vis others. If you will take a mature adult and say, cancel out your being a child. Cancel out your being a spouse. Cancel out your being a parent. Cancel out your being a neighbor. Cancel out your being a citizen. Cancel out your being a mathematician, because that's done according to standards of a group of other mathematicians. Right? What? How much are you going to have left? How much of self is there if you cancel out all those roles that are socially determined? But we have this false self-told story that really we are disconnected in this way, and I think that's a tragic mistake. Okay, we'll try to finish this next time in the session.
So it's our ability to understand the
there's got to be a way to turn this off. Come on. It's just a second. This says it's the on-off button. It says, well, maybe if I just press it quickly. No? How would you turn it off? Yeah, that's what I would do, too. Oh, I